supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
We'll also talk to legendary sustainable farmer Joel Salatin. And that's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Sharon, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Sharon. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I am doing just fine today. And where is Sharon Fine, may I ask?
I am in Sea Level, North Carolina.
I've never heard of that.
I didn't think you would.
And are you at sea level?
Sea Level is at sea level.
And is it a beachfront community?
Well, it's on the Sound. It's a little fishing village. It has about 300 people, maybe.
That sounds delightful.
Yeah.
All right. What can we do for Sharon in Sea Level, North Carolina?
Well, we had Hurricane Irene here a couple of weeks ago, and we got about 5 feet of water in our yard.
Ooh.
We got about a foot in the house, but my gardens were just ruined. And so I was wondering what I should do to kind of get the soil back in good order. And also, I had some blackberry bushes and some strawberry plants that just seemed to, you know, die. I don't know if I can revive them.
You know,
and also, I had a bunch of sweet potatoes, and if I can find any of those, they'd be safe to eat.
Now, how long was the garden physically underwater?
Only about half an hour.
Oh,
but
okay.
It also, you know, washed up all these, like, branches and pine straw.
Yeah,
and
sure. But
mud,
no,
basically, yeah.
No oil slicks, no obvious sludge or trash, hypodermic needles.
No.
Okay. But obviously the sweet potatoes, you don't see the foliage above ground anymore.
No.
That would be really nice if they could grow some more.
Yeah. For a while, I thought they might make it, but then they just died quietly.
Well, can I eat something that may have been exposed to nasty stuff is always a matter of personal preference. I don't know if you're an organic gardener or if you use a lot of chemicals, but anybody who's spraying their plants with Seven all season long is definitely more toxified than somebody who eats a sweet potato that was under what looked like just decent sound water for half an hour.
Oh, okay.
And of course, you know, they're still going to be good for slipping next year. You know, you can cure them, and the slips that you would get from those sweet potatoes would be fine.
Okay.
Now, I will tell you that it is easier to revive a plant that has gone without water for a long period of time than it is to bring back one that drowned.
Yeah.
I noticed that some of my containers in my own garden apparently had become a little too flush to the ground, and I lost a lot of my baby watermelons, of which I was having the best season ever. And clearly the containers were waterlogged and the plants just drowned. So now, obviously, strawberries are something that you would see. Are they still in place? Are they blackened plants? Or are
you... They're still there, but they're all, you know, brown and disgusting.
And things have dried out a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And
we hardly had any rain since then.
And you haven't done anything.
I just pulled out the trash around it.
Okay,
you know.
Good. And the blackberry plants, did they change appearance?
The stems are still pretty green, but the leaves are all brown and dead.
Yeah, but it's the end of the season. The leaves aren't going to photosynthesize much anymore anyway.
Okay.
And they're deciduous. Blackberries are tough. Now, I will say the only thing that really kills blackberries and raspberries is wet feet. So the one thing we don't know is how long the roots were saturated. We know when the water receded back into the Sound, but we don't know how long the roots set in water without any oxygen in it, or soil without any oxygen in it.
Right.
But the good news here is the best thing you can do is nothing. Just let the plants be. they would begin going dormant pretty soon, even in North Carolina, anyway. So any little spark of life they have left in them is already moving in towards the parts of the plant that store energy for the following season. How long had your strawberries been out in their strawberry bed?
One bed, it was the second year, and then the other bed, it was the first year.
Oh, you poor thing. Yes. Well, you know, I hate to do this, but I have to remind you of the name of your town, Sharon.
I know.
Now, there's no reason to believe this isn't going to happen again. Let's be honest here. We're talking about strawberry pots. We're talking about trying to get as high above ground as we can. You know, there's a new style of containers that are up on legs that are a good couple feet up off the ground. I don't know how old you are, but as I get older, I like the idea of, you know, weed pulling being at the level while I'm standing up. So if you're going to continue to garden, I think you have to face the physical reality of your situation. But otherwise, I think you're probably going to have a lot of replanting to do. And the only thing I can suggest to you is grow up and try to get the roots up another foot higher in the ground. With you in North Carolina, you can have your stuff higher off the ground and have it not be so much of an issue over winter as I could in Pennsylvania. But
right,
I think you have
right.
to look at that water and think that it's going to come back and you're going to make your plans.
Yeah, we have had other flooding, but not that much, you know.
I think it's garden redesign time, and really consider extremely raised beds, literally gardening up on stilts like a lot of the beach houses down there.
Huh.
All right.
Well, that would be a trip. Okay.
All right, Shar. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Karen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I live in Upper Black Eddy, Pennsylvania.
Very good. What can we do for Karen in Upper Black Eddy?
I'd say about 7 or 8 years ago, I got about 30 hollies from one of the big box stores. End of the season, they were on clearance. They all claim to be the female variety. They're growing beautifully. They're all over my property. Some are in the back to get morning sun, afternoon shade, and a lot of them are in the front where they get the afternoon, like 1 o'clock on. They're all growing well, but maybe a few of them get maybe 5 or 6 berries on them. That's it, and I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
Karen, didn't you ever take biology in high school?
It wasn't my favorite class.
You are far from the first person that this has happened to. This is a classic issue with hollies. And because many types of hollies, not all, but many types do need a male to pollinate it. It does not have to be a similarly named male, but you do need a male holly that pollinates at the same time, and some of the males pollinate at different times of years. Some people have done what you've done. They've put in 20 or 30 females. They get lots of berries, and then 1 year they call me up and say, all of a sudden, my hollies didn't produce any berries. What happened? And I said, somebody cut down their boyfriend a quarter mile away.
But so that's definitely it. It's not that there's a lack of bees pollinating.
No, it's just you're on the Amazon princess island of Wonder Woman. There's a distinct lack of testosterone in your holly planting. Do you have any of the original tags or any of the original names?
I believe they're the Blue Princess.
Okay. And you know what? I suggest you go to a garden center now. Mm-hmm. I suggest you're going to have to go to real garden centers this time, real independent garden centers, and tell them you need, there may even be something like an all-purpose male that's going, you know, that's, you know, in its final year of high school and it's just trying to pollinate all the time. You only need a single male plant.
Just one. And, does it have to be a bigger, more mature one? Or
no.
I did buy a male.
But
it's small.
Well, the bigger the male, the more pollen it's going to produce, the more flowers it's going to fertilize. As your man gets bigger, you'll get more berries. You go out and spend the money to get a big man, and you'll have a much better yield of berries. And other than getting a male that pollinates at the same time as your young ladies, just don't use any chemicals in that garden, because you're absolutely right. The pollen is carried by bees. This is not something where you got to hit the center of the target. If you go out and get a good, healthy male who's producing lots of pollen, you're going to have a show that's going to be unbelievable.
And do you think if I get one this year, like this, and
oh, yes, fall,
now, I can have possible berries next fall?
Absolutely. Fall is the best time for planting, and the survival rate of plants put in the ground in the fall is much greater than in the spring.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
All right.
I just thought out of all those, one of them had to have been a male. And
Nope. They told you the truth. You have a hen house without a rooster, dear.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that the time is ripe for the reseeding and overseeding of cool season lawns. It's also time to aerate cool season turfs whose soil has become compacted, and to dethatch ones with lots of shaky stolons showing. And it's time to give cool season lawns their biggest feeding of the year. But don't go leaping to the rescue of your rye, bluegrass, or fescue just yet, because we'll be right back with organic, sustainable farmer Joel Salatin, how to keep garlic happy enough to produce big bulbs for you next year, and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
It's the perfect time to tune in to Mike McGrath and You Bet Your Garden. It's 11:19. This is WHYY.
WHYY reaches among the most educated, professional, and culturally minded listeners in the region, your ideal audience. To learn how Honor messages on WHYY can benefit your company, call Penny Jardines at 215-351-3310.
Medford Lees proudly supports WHYY, a Quaker-related, not-for-profit community celebrating 40 years of service. Medford Lees offers two campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, featuring arboretum settings, residential home designs ranging from townhouses to garden-style apartments, varied contract options, a self-governing residence association, and comprehensive on-site wellness and health services. Further details at 800-331-4302 or medfordlees.org.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, featuring a luxury hybrid that gets an estimated 41 miles per gallon in the city, a crossover that uses voice and touch commands, and a sedan featuring available active park assist technology. Lincoln, it's not just luxury, it's smarter than that.
Don't forget to join Mike McGrath for a live web chat this Wednesday at noon. Mike will walk you through growing garlic, fall greens, pansies, and more. And if you have a fall planting question, this is the perfect time to ask it. And to sign up, just go to visit whyy.org/garden. Actually, just visit whyy.org/garden.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we'll be planting garlic. We'll be reminding you of a little trick we learned a couple years ago that helps keep neck rot and other dreaded garlic diseases at bay. And we'll discuss the possibility of growing garlic in containers. But now it's time to welcome our very special guest, Joel Salatin, a third-generation farmer in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, author of numerous books, including Holy Cows and Hog Heaven, and my favorite title, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. Joel will be among the speakers, along with Christina Perillo, next weekend at a big forum in Cape May titled Guess What's Coming to Dinner? The Politics of Food in the 21st Century. All right, Joel Salatin, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be with you.
It's great to be with you, sir, especially since I read through your biography and found that your grandfather, father, perhaps even you personally, had been influenced by J.I. Rodale, the founder of Organic Gardening, the magazine I was proud to be editor of for 7 years.
Yes, absolutely. My paternal grandfather was a charter subscriber, I understand. I mean, in other words, charter, he was in the first wave of subscribers. My understanding is that organic gardening and farming at that time, it was launched as organic farming and gardening. And it wasn't until they switched gardening and put gardening first that it really, really took off.
That is absolutely correct, and I think you're actually more correct about him being a charter subscriber, which means he beat us out for hundreds and hundreds of dollars. In the first years of the magazine, J.I. said something like, send me $5 and you'll be a lifetime subscriber. Now, Joel, your Polyface Farm in Virginia's yes. Shenandoah Valley, is this the same land your parents and grandparents cultivated?
Well, the same ones my parents did. My grandfather was in Indiana. My dad and mom's roots are both in the Midwest, and we came here in 1961 to the farm here in Virginia. I was just 4 when we came.
And you have a fairly large farm. You practice a technique of farming that seems very geared towards livestock, towards cattle and pigs and chickens, that you call beyond organic. Tell us a little bit about what you do that you consider an improvement, I'm guessing, on the legal definition of organic.
Yes, that is correct. So what we do is we run mixed livestock, and we run them on pastures. So that they're outside, except for a couple months in the dead of winter when we have snow, but otherwise they're on pastures. They're in portable shelters, so they're moved every day or two to a brand new paddock. You know, chickens, turkeys, cows, rabbits, pigs, everything gets moved in this choreographed what we call ballet in the pasture to mimic the kind of movement and patterns that you see worldwide with animals, whether it's birds or you know, wildebeests or whatever. You know, throughout the world, animals are always moving, and they're always, you know, they're always heading to fresh ground. And so that's what we're doing with high-tech electric fencing, portable infrastructure. We're able to mimic those kinds of patterns like a template on this landscape.
Because that is a big issue in the quote-unquote organic community now, as people are becoming aware that products labeled organic can come from animals that were confined all their lives, that really never got to roam around on grasslands. And
sure.
I have to tell you, I am lucky enough to live 6 miles from an organic dairy farm that's not only organic, but it's all grass-fed.
There you go.
They consider that more important than organic, and I imagine you might as well.
Yes, absolutely. The fact is that if you take what I call the salad bar, where you make sure that each of those animals can ingest or wants to ingest the greatest amount of salad bar that its physiology, its phenotype can allow it to ingest. Obviously, it's different from different kinds of animals, omnivores, herbivores, that sort of thing. But if those animals are encouraged and allowed to be in a habitat that encourages them to ingest the maximum amount of green material, then you see just they're just off the chart differences, you know, in quantities. Mother Earth News actually did paid for 12 of us around the country that were doing pastured eggs for a nutrient profile compared to the USDA, you know, a standard nutrition label on eggs.
Oh, that's almost unfair. That's like beating up the little sisters of the poor.
And I mean, the differences were not like 10% and 20%. It was like folic acid was like, standard was 43 micrograms, you know, per egg, and ours was 1,200 micrograms of folic acid per egg. I mean, and it was just, it's just off the charts.
And I will tell you, as somebody who has slowly come around to only enjoying local grass-fed milk and locally raised chicken. That was my epiphany. Oh, my God, I can never eat regular chicken again.
it ruins you, doesn't it?
It really does. And this is one of the things that I tried to explain to people in the beginning about even the fledgling organic, that this is the real gourmet. It's the quality with which the food was raised and handled and respected.
Yes, grain-fed beef is bland. You know, supermarket chicken is bland. When, you know, pork, when the industry says pork the other white meat, you know, one of the most famous monikers ever created by the pork checkoff program, pork the other white meat, well, pork's not supposed to be white. You know, it's supposed to be rose-colored because of the exercise and the green material the pigs are eating. Our pork is not white. It's rose-colored.
Now, why do you call your pork, speaking of pork, pigerator pork?
Well, for two reasons. We really developed that phrase when we began using pigs years ago to build our compost. You know, we were generating these large volumes of material from the winter feeding in the hay shed, this deep bedding, you know, under the cows, and we would make these windrow compost piles, you know, and did it all. And one day I was actually speaking at a conference in Southwest Virginia, and one of the other speakers that I went to hear was from the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, and she was just showing slides of numerous, you know, breeds of pigs. And this one slide came up with this pig standing on a pile of stable bedding from a horse stable outfit, and it just struck me like an epiphany. Well, goodness, you know, here we are, we're double handling, we're using all this petroleum and heavy machinery to build these windrows. Why don't we just let pigs do this? And so we came home and prototyped it, and now we make, you know, hundreds of tons of compost where we just layer corn in there with the cows in the wintertime and let the bedding build up. Bedding would be, you know, wood chips, straw, old hay, sawdust, any kind of carbonation material, peanut hulls, okay? And it just builds up. It'll get, you know, 3 or 4 feet deep over the, you know, the winter cycle. And it's got, and it's fermenting because the cows tromp out the oxygen, so that bedding pack actually ferments and ferments that corn in there that the cows just tromp in. And then when the cows come out in the spring and start grazing grass, we put in the pig aerators, like, you know, aerobic dance, like aeration, and the pigs then seek, you know, all pigs have a sign on their forehead, "We'll work for corn," and they seek that fermented corn in the bedding pack. And in doing so, they fluff it and aerate it, and the pigs do all of that work and save us mountains of diesel fuel, time, energy, machinery, and they love to do it, you know, and it fully honors and respects the pigness of the pig.
Now, Joel, though, I mean, clearly you're trying to spread the gospel of sanity. And I know you do a tremendous number of speaking gigs every year, and you've got other partners in your little Justice League like Michael Pollan. But let's be honest here. This is like trying to turn a battleship. This is a this is a country that's used to cheap food, and the concept of cheap food keeping people happy goes back to, like, Roman times, to the times of the gladiators. What makes you not Don Quixote, or are you proudly Don Quixote?
Well, you know, I call myself the lunatic farmer, which is, of course, just part of the humor of, yes, of being odd and weird and enjoying it. But why is this not Don Quixote? Well, first of all, you know, I actually can't be responsible. None of us, you, me, nobody can be responsible for the culture not seeing the truth. All we can do is, it's kind of like, you know, we plant the seed. We can't be responsible for the germination, but what we do is we plant seeds. And so, yeah, you're right. I plant this gospel, if you will, but ultimately, whether people will accept it and believe it before more calamity occurs is I'm not responsible for that. I'm not responsible for your belief system. And you're right. You know, in the last 35 years, our country has exchanged an 18% per capita expenditure on food and 9% on health care to today, 9% on food and 18% on health care.
That's a bad trade.
Yeah, yeah. We've inverted those two numbers. And I would suggest, you know, wouldn't the average person rather be healthy and spend more money on food and not spend it on health care? And so, I mean, if you actually sat down and thought about it a little bit.
And I got to tell you, Joel, as somebody who made the jump from just insisting on organic to really discovering the glory of locally raised, sustainable, humanely raised food. All you got to do is taste this stuff, and it'll win you over completely.
Yeah, yeah. At the end of the day, what's going to save us and save the food system is not organic Twinkies.
Yeah, Joel. I good luck to you, my child.
Thank you.
Joel Salatin is a self-described Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. He will be one of the keynote speakers next weekend when the Cape May Forum hosts Guess What's Coming to Dinner? The Politics of Food in the 21st Century in Cape May, New Jersey. Joel, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ellen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. How are you?
I'm well, and we enjoy your show, especially my children.
Excellent, excellent. And where are we well?
Princeton Junction, New Jersey.
Very good. What can we do for Ellen in Princeton Junction?
We have a 15-year-old raspberry patch, and we don't have ever-bearing raspberries or even summer-bearing. They tend to come in the spring, and then they die back, and then we have beautiful raspberries for Thanksgiving. However, this year, I see that we don't have very many raspberries at all, and I wanted to get your recommendations on how we can increase their fruit-bearing again.
Okay, so there are a couple of different types of raspberries.
We have red ones, by the way.
Sounds like what you have now is like mine, Heritage. I can never remember which is ever-bearing and which is fall-bearing, but mine, in the spring, send up lots of new shoots out of the ground.
Yes.
At the very end of the season, I think you said Thanksgiving, the tips of those shoots produce very large berries.
That's right.
And then the plants go dormant over the winter, and then those same canes produce a second flush of berries in the spring. And those berries might be a little bit smaller, but there tend to be a lot more of them because they're produced up and down the cane. And then that cane dies off.
What we see is that in December, after we get the fruit, we actually cut the canes to the ground. We compost, sometimes fertilize, but we compost, and then we wait till the spring when they grow back again.
Why are you doing that? I think you might be robbing yourself of the bigger harvest.
The bigger harvest when?
In very early summer, on the canes that would have produced on the canes that you pulled out in December. You know, in the woods, nobody's doing this stuff.
I know.
Nobody is messing with these things. First of all, I have never fed my raspberries.
Mm-hmm.
My raspberries are older than your raspberries. Mm-hmm. The patch is 25 years old at this point. They have never actually been fed. Every fifth or sixth year, I will shovel some shredded fall leaves around them just because I think I should be doing something and to help keep the weeds down.
Yeah.
But raspberries react very badly to fertilization. They should not be fertilized every year, and they should never be fertilized heavily. What have you been fertilizing them with?
Well, we put compost on. Perhaps right. We'll put a 10-10-10 solution.
Oh, no, 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 no. First of all, there's no plant in the world that wants equal amounts of nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. That's a marketing ploy. 10-10-10 appeals to your arithmetic sense. No plant in the world wants that. Plus, that's way too much nitrogen. You're preventing flowering and fruiting right there.
Okay.
And it's a chemical salt. That's a purely artificial fertilizer. And you're negating the effects of your compost, and you are salting your soil over time. The answer to successful raspberry growing is find a part of your land that drains well, put the raspberry canes in the ground in the spring, and then pick and enjoy them for years afterwards.
Well, we do that. They're in an open area, in a very well-draining area, and as I said, it's not a young patch. We have found that more of the canes have died this year maybe because it's weedy. We also planted watermelons in there this summer because it's a really big open patch.
Okay, I would not do that.
Yeah, and I think maybe that affected it.
Yeah. No more fertilizer.
Okay.
And if you've actually put compost back there every year, no more compost for a while.
Okay.
They are overfed, and especially the 10-10-10. That's a guaranteed way to limit the number of fruits you get. And they're not going to be as good tasting because they're going to be filled with water and salt.
They're always good tasting, I must tell you.
Yeah, they're going to be better tasting without the 10-10-10. Trust me on this.
Yeah, so don't prune them at all.
No.
Even if they're over 5 feet.
Yeah,
this
why?
It's different from everything that we've read, so that's why I'm just asking.
Oh, don't read. Don't read. I mean, there ought to be you ought to have a license to write these books.
Should we top them off or no, or don't do anything?
You may. You may cut off the top foot of each cane if that appeals to the inner Martha Stewart in you. But otherwise, just to placate me, just to prove me wrong, let the canes stand, the first year canes, and then I want you to call me late next June and tell me what happened.
Great.
Okay?
I will. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck.
Take care. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that it's pansy time again. Practically unique in the world of flowers, pansies laugh at cold weather but melt away in the summer heat. Most people plant them in the spring, but they're available at garden centers right now, giving you bonus blooms all fall and winter. And the flowers are edible as well. But don't you go veering towards violas just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to grow garlic indoors and out. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garlic. Back at you with local events. I'll host a fundraiser for the historic Fairhill Burial Ground tomorrow evening, Sunday, September 18th, from 5 to 8 p.m. at the University Barge Club on Boathouse Row. Next Saturday, September 24th, I'll get you ready to plant garlic, pansies, fall greens, and more at 1:30 at the Lower Gwynedd Country Picnic at Penlin Pike and Township Line Road. Joel Salatin and Christina Perillo headline a huge celebration of local sustainable food in Cape May, New Jersey, next Friday through Sunday, and the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society holds their fall festival from 10 to 4 next Saturday at the Navy Yard. Free admission and fun for all. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
This week on This American Life.
It's like people can't imagine it. You know, there's a loud din of people talking and dishes and all that stuff going on in a restaurant. And somebody will ask me, well, how loud is it right now? And I'll often say, it's the loudest thing in the room.
A man gets a sound stuck in his head and can't get it out this week.
Tomorrow at noon on WHYY.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY. It's 11:39. We have cloudy skies, 64 degrees on Independence Mall.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, wherein we will cover basic garlic planting. It's time to get those cloves in the ground, cats and kittens. We will discuss how to protect your precious garlic against neck rots and other soil-borne diseases. And we will also discuss the interesting possibility of growing your garlic in a container, which I would have said was impossible before, but maybe I've changed my mind. We'll find out after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Julia, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Julia. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I am doing just fine today. Thank you. Where are you, Julia?
I'm in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Oh, the punchline of a famous Groucho Marx routine. You know, that's what
I've heard this, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, because that's right at Tuscaloosa. All right. You've heard that way too many times. What can we do for Julia in Tuscaloosa?
Well, I'm calling because our house was hit by the tornado that came through Tuscaloosa last April, we're sort of finishing up the construction of rebuilding, and we're ready to tackle the yard, which has been absolutely demolished. Lots and lots of very big trees were taken down and removed from our yard, and so there are craters, and mimosa is now growing in places that it never grew, you know, just lots and lots of weeds and bare patches. And so we're trying to decide whether to seed or to sod.
Okay, we definitely want a lawn out there to some degree.
We do. The backyard dimensions are about 100 feet by 220 feet, so it's really big. And we're going to do the last maybe 20 feet or so with trees and all around the perimeter. But, yeah, the main area we do want to do with grass.
I don't have any objections to lawns. They're great big plants. They're green. They utilize rainwater very efficiently. They produce oxygen. They're great for rolling around on with your kids. So I don't have anything against lawns. Now, however, the fact that you're in Alabama means that typically you would go for a warm season grass rather than the cool season grasses we grow here in Pennsylvania. So have you chosen a type of grass that you'd like to live with?
Well, I've been looking at Bermuda. It seems to be really heat tolerant and drought resistant, which we've certainly had problems with these last couple of years. So that seems to be well situated for our area.
Okay, good, good, good. Bermuda is a very tough choice. I will tell you, by definition, the warm season grasses tend not to get overly stressed in summer. Warm season grasses have their hardest time in the winter. The same way that when we grow our cool season grasses, they can't stand our summer. So your Bermuda grass is really primed for heat, although you will have to irrigate a little bit to keep it green. But even extended drought probably wouldn't kill it if you manage it well while it's growing. It would just go dormant. Now, I have good news and bad news. Which do you want first?
The good.
The good news is that you have plenty of time to prepare your growing surface.
That's what I was afraid of.
Yeah, because warm season grasses are only going to establish well in the springtime. But in your case, I think that's a very good thing, even though it may not seem it to you, because it seems like we still have a lot of preparation to do. So the bottom line is sod is much more expensive than seed. It would be prohibitive, I would think, to lay a carpet, a traditional carpet of sod, over the area that you have. Now, Bermuda grass typically is installed via plugs or sprigs, you know, which is basically sod that's been cut up or punched up, and it's installed at the correct time of year, and then those different little pieces spread into each other, because Bermuda, like the corollary in cool season grasses, Kentucky bluegrass, is a spreading grass. It will fill in its own bare spots or the spots in between the plugs. My understanding is in the past there were no reliable seeds for warm season grasses, but I've been led to believe that that's not true anymore. And you can probably get high quality Bermuda grass seed as well. Seed is going to be the least expensive. And at this point, you can buy a real premium named variety. You're not cheapening out at all. The plugs or sprigs would be in the middle, and it would cost you a fortune to carpet that yard in pure sod. Although, obviously, when you do the pure sod, you just beat the weeds up. They don't have a chance. But you scared me when you said you got mimosa trees coming up.
Oh, yeah, and bamboo.
Oh, well, you see, there's no point in doing anything until we get those puppies under control. And there's no weed killer you can spray on bamboo that's going to control it. So what you have to do, if there's bamboo there, you need to physically remove that. And if it's coming over from somebody else's property or something, you've got to install a rhizome barrier between you and the bamboo. But your job over the next 6 months or so is to get out all these big spreading plants. The bamboo, I'm warning you, I want you to go to our website You Bet Your Garden. Go to Garden Answers A to Z and read all the articles on bamboo, because you really need to take bamboo seriously. It's the black plague of weeds. But this gives you time to get the big problem weeds out of there, to have a big load of compost and screen topsoil delivered, level that out over the winter, and then you will have a level area that should be weed-free to either plant your sprigs or plugs or sow your seed in as soon as the soil warms up. And your local county extension agent will be able to give you good dates for seeding, sprigging, and plugging. Seeding, okay. You're going to have to wait until the soil temperature is a certain level, because you want all the seed to sprout right away and be really viable. Plugs and sprigs, they can go in at cooler temperatures, but you're wasting all your time and money if you don't get rid of the weeds. Add some organic matter to the soil so you can get going on a good footing. But most importantly, believe it or not, the lawn will never do well if you don't level the surface in advance of any seeding, sprigging, or plugging.
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Good luck, Julia, and I'm glad you got through the tornado okay personally.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. You take care.
Thanks.
1-888-346-9499. Elizabeth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hi, Mike. It's so nice to talk to you. We have enjoyed listening to your program for so long.
Why, thank you. That's very kind of you to say, Elizabeth. Where are we?
In Dayton, Ohio.
Okay, very good. We hear from a lot of you folks. What can
that's great. Well, I have a question about when to sow seeds from annuals and biennials.
Okay.
I don't much question columbine, because columbine comes so early in the season, they drop their own seeds, and you see their greens starting up. I'm talking about later season plants like snapdragons, larkspur, and poppies. Do I follow Mother Nature, and when I cut down those plants that are finished and drop them on the ground, or do I save them and put them in the spring?
I'm no expert in ornamentals, and sometimes my memory is a little faulty.
Okay.
But I seem to recall that they are the poster children for fall sowing.
Fall, okay.
Yes. A lot of plants, if you look up the individual proclivities of the seeds of certain ornamentals, some of them need a winter chill. Some of the harder to germinate seeds will require being roughed up with sandpaper. The really exotic ones may need to be treated with fire or smoke. But the most common is a chilling requirement that, rather than kill this seed, primes it to know that the one season is over, it's dormant now, and when things warm up, it's time to rock and roll again.
Well, so then basically what you're saying is I follow Mother Nature, and if when I am pulling these spent plants up...
If you must pull the plants, I would delay until I thought that a lot of seed had dropped naturally, and then I would do the shaky-shaky thing. First, I would clean the area to make sure there weren't a lot of whole leaves around to smother things.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then after I did the shaky-shaky thing, I would throw a little bit of compost over top of the soil. And then if any further whole leaves fell in that area, I would use a leaf vac to suck them up and shred them. I wouldn't be hesitant to empty the bag right on that spot again. Whole leaves are the enemy of understory plants. Trees use their leaves to smother undergrowth around them so that there's less competition for food and water. We can fool the trees and utilize those whole leaves as the world's greatest mulch and soil nutrients simply by shredding them and taking away their power to slam other plants.
Okay.
I think you got a great plan. Just do a little bit to make sure they land in a nice spot. Let them do it naturally as much as they can. Cover them over a little bit, and then make sure they don't get covered over with like 6 inches of wet leaves, because, you know, that just turns into a tarp.
Right. Okay.
All right.
Very good. Well, I appreciate your advice. Thank you so much for your help.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. It's time for the question of the week. let's get some garlic in the ground. Kathy in Hopewell, New Jersey starts us off with, you recently identified the scourge on my tomato plants as a soil-borne wilt. Thank you. Now I'm currently sorting my garlic harvest. Would it be okay to plant my new garlic where the wilted tomatoes were? I have such a small plot of land to garden in. Well, most of us are severely space-challenged, Kath. That's why rotating your tomatoes to different spots every year can be so challenging, but essential, as you discovered this season when you got hit by the, oops, looks like tomatoes did grow in that spot last season, wilt. Now, I personally like to follow tomatoes with garlic, but garlic can fall prey to its own diseases and develop neck rot, which is why I now rotate my garlic to a new bed every season as well as my tomatoes. And this year is further insurance against the loss of even a single bulb. I just loves my garlic. I plan to add a big batch of soil-free mix to my beds to improve the drainage. And I'll use a neat disease-fighting trick that my old magazine, Organic Gardening, revealed back in 2008. Mix 1 tablespoon each of baking soda and liquid seaweed into a quart of water. Let the cloves sit in the mix for 2 hours and then plant. I suggest you do the same. Lighten up your soil to improve the drainage. Treat the bulbs with the baking soda and seaweed mix. And, of course, think good thoughts. We move on to Eileen in Norman, Oklahoma, who has an intriguing question. Is it possible to grow garlic indoors, she asks. I have a window in my kitchen that gets sunlight in the afternoon and was wondering if I can try and grow some garlic in a pot. Well, the basic answer is no. Like fruit trees, asparagus, and spring bulbs, garlic is one of those plants that really wants to be outdoors and in the ground over winter. But a friend of mine with high hopes and a lot of youthful exuberance, which is now being drained by a delightful first child, congratulations, Patrick and Helena, did kind of manage it once. And more importantly, September is garlic planting time, so let's discuss both ways. Now, the best way to plant garlic is, of course, right in the ground. Find a good local or mail-order source of planting garlic. Don't use regular supermarket garlic. It's treated not to grow again. Carefully pull the bulbs apart and plant individual cloves about 6 inches deep and 6 inches apart in your loosest, richest soil. Mulching the bed with an inch or two of shredded leaves will protect the soil from heaving during roller coaster winters and prevent weeds, which are the bane of garlic growing. The garlic shoots will easily be able to push through that leaf mulch and might even appear later that fall. Fine if they do and fine if they don't. The important thing is to give the cloves a month or two to grow good strong roots before the soil freezes and the garlic goes dormant for the winter. Late the following spring, hardneck northern varieties will produce a little bulge at the top of their central stalk, it's called the scape, that'll become a weedy, seedy mess if you don't remove it. But hey, it's now May or June and it's the first thing you gotta do. And you get to eat the scapes with dinner that night. Softneck varieties, also known as white or California garlic, don't scape. So if you grow them, you get to be even lazier. Then you harvest your bulbs when the bottom third of the plants turns brown, which is typically late June through mid-July. To imitate this process in a pot, you'd select a nice big container that drains extremely well and fill it with 3/4 of a soil-free mix and 1/4 compost. Don't use your lousy garden soil, and don't put pebbles, peanuts, old pot shards, or other junk in the bottom. Plant your cloves and then leave the pot outside until frost, or just sit it anywhere at room temperature indoors. You can save your pitiful windowsill for killing houseplants. The underground cloves don't need sun at this point, just a warm environment and occasional light watering. But when winter arrives, you're going to have to chill this setup. I seem to recall that Patrick did this by dragging the pot down to the coldest part of the house and leaving it near a drafty back door. The pot should not stay outside all winter. A long, hard freeze would kill those above-ground cloves. But the cloves must get a good chill, 3 or 4 months at 35 to 45 degrees Fahrenheit. Watering during this time must be very light. Waterlogged bulbs will rot. then beginning in March, the plants must get as much sun as possible, and the vast majority of windows are not up to the job. Now, if you think you got a real winter, east-facing and all-day sun, or even better, a greenhouse-type bay window, you can try placing the container there, or position a shop light directly over top of the sprouts, as directed in our articles on seed saving and pepper overwintering. But the best thing to do would be to find a place outdoors for it after the worst of winter is over. If you have no such place, ask a friend with a yard to babysit your garlic to be. Either way, give the bulbs a nice feeding when the sprouts are a couple inches tall. Spread an inch of worm castings or high-quality compost over the top of the soil. Or, if it's going outdoors, water with a nice liquid organic fish and seaweed mixture. Don't use these indoors, kids. They're stinky. Well, that sure was an interesting take on garlic growing, now wasn't it? Luckily for yous, this and every question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read our excellent advice in detail, this week including lots more information on garlic growing and that secret disease-fighting recipe, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to commandeer my cloves if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Tell us where you live. Put the actual subject in the subject line and check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin, don't call me Merv, Griffin. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Overworked Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Alleviating some of that load is our brand new intern, Julia Worski. Hardworking Al Banks is our editor. I'm hardly working Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. It's the time of year for hibernating insects to try and move in with us. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how to trap stink bugs and other invaders before and after they get in, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Tune in for Mike next week, You Bet Your Garden, next Saturday at 11 on WHYY.
Folkways at Gwynedd supports WHYY.